Like a con man on the run, L.A. buries its past. Maybe that's why no one argued when the sentence came down. The Faubourg had to die. I live in a company town where the product is illusion. In the alternate universe ruled by sociopaths who make movies, communication means snappy dialogue. The scalpel trumps genetics, and permanence is mortal sin because it slows down the chute. L.A. used to have more Victorian mansions than San Francisco, but L.A. called in the wrecking ball, and all that handwork gave way to 30s bungalows that yielded to 50s dingbats, which were vanquished in turn by big-box adult dormitories with walls a toddler can put a fist through. Preservationists try to stem the erosion, but end up fighting for the likes of gas stations and ticky-tack motels. Money changes hands, zoning laws are finessed, and masterpieces like the Ambassador Hotel dissolve like wrinkles shot with Botox. The Faubourg Hotel was no ambassador, but it did have its charm. 4 somber stories of colonial brickface, it sat on a quiet block of Crescent Drive in Beverly Hills, wedged between a retirement home and a dry cleaner. A short walk, but a psychic universe from the Eurotrash cafes of Cannon Drive and the shopping frenzy on Beverly and Rodeo, the Faubourg appeared in few guidebooks, but managed to boast one of the highest occupancy rates in the city. Built in 1949 by a French Holocaust survivor, its design aped the mansions in the American movies that had transfixed Marcel Jabotinsky as a teenager. Jabotinsky's first guests were other post-war émigrés seeking peace and quiet. That same desire for low-key serenity continued with the hotel's clientele, divided between the genteel grandparents of Eurotrash and the odd, knowledgeable American willing to trade glitz and edgy and ironic for a decent night's sleep. I knew the Faubourg because I drank there. The lounge at the back was smallish and dim with nothing to prove, paneled in dark rift oak, and hung with middling Barbizon landscapes. The 80-year-old hunchback behind the bar concocted the best sidecar in town, and Robin likes sidecars. An assortment of pianists, mostly former studio musicians on pension, worked the big black Steinway in the left-hand corner, never intruding upon the pleasant buzz of conversation and the harmonious clink of crystal glasses. The staff was attentive without being nosy. The snacks were decent, and you left the place feeling as if you'd been re-civilized. Robin and I spent a lot of Sunday evenings in a cracked leather rear booth, holding hands, nibbling on cheese crackers, and inhaling Gershwin. One Saturday morning in the spring, Robin was delivering a new guitar to an aging rock star who lived in the flats of Beverly Hills, and the drive took her past the Faubourg. A sign strung up over the fanlight announced, "Last night tomorrow. Come celebrate or mourn with us. Thanks for the good times. The family of Marcel Jabotinsky." Robin shouldn't have been surprised. The previous week we'd shown up at a Thai place we'd enjoyed for half a decade, only to find an abyss surrounded by chain link where the building had stood. The month before that, she'd run into an old high school friend and asked how her husband was.
"Which one?"
"Jeff." The woman laughed.
"Jeff's ancient history, sweetie. Cliff's recent history, but he's gone too."
Tissue paper city. Robin said, "Not much of a choice, is it? Surrender to the inevitable or risk a whole bunch of mawkish nostalgia?" We sat on the living room couch with Blanche, our little French bulldog, squeezed between us and following the back and forth. I said, "I can go either way." She pulled on a curl, let it spring back.
"What the heck? I'll never get a sidecar that good, and it's a chance to put on a dress."
"I'll wear a suit."
"I like you in a suit, darling, but not the black one. Let's pretend it won't be a funeral."
Who? Who knew?